I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Catherine Archuleta, the director of the Office of Personnel Management, resigned earlier this month because of her mishandling of a massive hack of personal information of more than 21 million current and former employees of the federal government. That included Social Security numbers, financial, health, and employment information, and fingerprints. This theft of such personal and private information has raised concerns about how much of our personal data is secure and whether our online communication is vulnerable to attack. Today in this hour of Radio Times, we're going to take a look at internet security, I guess, and insecurity, whether anonymity and privacy in our increasingly digital world is even possible. We begin our conversation with Brittany Bacon. She's associate with Hunton and Williams LLP, specializing in privacy and cybersecurity for Fortune 500 companies, responding to regulation inquiries related to cybersecurity incidents. And Brittany Bacon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Very nice to be here, Marty. Thank you.
You're welcome. How much has this OPM hack basically sent shivers through the business world?
It absolutely has sounded the alarms once again. This is just another example of the many, many sophisticated and scary attacks that have been launched against consumers over the past couple of years. Following the Target breach, we truly are living in a different environment, and the awareness around security breaches is higher than ever.
As you said, once again, this is a massive hack. Does it show that the hackers are getting more sophisticated, that they're doing, in a sense, a better job getting into our data?
I think it does. Over the past couple of years, we have seen the size, the sophistication, and the urgency of the cyber attacks grow. We're dealing really with three different groups of bad actors. One are the hacktivists. These are the groups that are out to embarrass and to cause a nuisance. We also have traditional hackers, which are looking to exfiltrate and sell data, personal information like social security numbers on the black market. And then we have nation states, which are the state-sponsored actors, also known as advanced persistent threats. They are the ones that can be in our systems for years going unnoticed and collecting data and using it in untoward ways.
Reading about this OPM attack, one of the criticisms is that the federal government really hasn't taken cybersecurity seriously enough. Would that be true for the business world as well?
It's interesting. I mean, there has been a huge push in the regulatory landscape, both the federal government and at the state level, to enforce and to require security for personal information. And to have the federal government itself a target of the breaches is quite astonishing. Companies are well aware and are becoming even more aware in recent times of the absolute need to make cybersecurity a top priority. It is very much a responsibility that lies with the C-suite executives. And we have seen companies invest significant resources into protecting their systems and their data even before an event happens, not only on a reactive basis, but also proactively.
I mean, is it a technological fix? Is that what it requires? Or is it also kind of a cultural fix as well, taking this seriously?
You absolutely nailed it. It's much more than a technical fix. Technical is certainly one very important piece of cybersecurity, but there is much to be said about the administrative controls and in implementing a privacy and cybersecurity culture within an organization is of utmost importance. It absolutely has to be top of mind for boards of directors, for senior management. And I can tell you from the work we've been doing with many of the largest and most sophisticated companies, it absolutely is.
Well, because it seems to me people's reputations are at stake here. We hear about some of these breaches, some of these attacks, and it does not reflect well on a company that's been vulnerable.
The reputational risks associated with the aftermath of a breach are incredibly significant. As you mentioned, we see resignations in connection with the OPM breach. you know, when we look at Target, for example, in the aftermath of that Target breach, the company CEO resigned while 7 of the 10 board members were recommended for ouster and were also stepping down as a result.
But it
there are significant ramifications from a reputational perspective.
Indeed. And it seems that companies often don't know they have been hacked or attacked until well after it's taken place. Why is that?
It depends. That you're right in that a lot of times these attacks, particularly the more sophisticated ones, occur months, if not years, before it's brought to the attention of the information security team. And companies are finding out about breaches in different ways, from the traditional, you know, their antivirus software picks it up and there's an alert generated, to the FBI or the Secret Service are now calling companies and letting them know, hey, you may have a problem, to payment card brands letting companies know that they are what's called a common point of purchase. They have credit cards that are being used in unauthorized ways, and it's associated with the company's security.
It seems these companies, though, do have some legal responsibility, don't they, to protect people's data?
They do. In the U.S., we actually have a patchwork of 47 different state breach notification laws, plus 4 in the territories and jurisdictions.
Wow.
Each of these laws, which makes compliance quite complicated, as you can imagine, each of these laws has different requirements with respect to notifying individuals and sometimes regulators in the event of a breach. And we also have a number of state security laws, which require that companies have in place appropriate security and safeguards to protect personal information at the state level.
Do we need more or better laws or more uniformity among laws?
It's the million-dollar question, and a lot is being done on the Hill. Bills are being proposed left and right at the federal level to try to come up with some sort of uniform approach, particularly on the breach notification and cybersecurity side. It has yet to happen, but there is now a better time than any other to get it passed. So there's definitely an emphasis on new legislation.
And are companies reluctant to share information for proprietary reasons because they want to protect, you know, certain information that's specific to their company?
You mean sharing information with federal government and
law
enforcement authorities?
Sure.
Yeah. It's a great point. So there has been a push since the 2013 executive order that the White House passed down on improving critical infrastructure cybersecurity. One key component of that is information sharing between private sector and the federal government and law enforcement authorities. So the White House is certainly pushing for it and encouraging it. Companies, though, while engaging much more frequently than we've ever seen with law enforcement and regulatory authorities, are certainly, you know, cognizant of sharing information like personal information, like proprietary information, when engaging in these activities. And it is certainly something to think about.
You talk about the threats from the hacktivists, from the traditional hackers, and also from nation states. Do you think there's a place for friendly hackers to be part of the solution?
Well, there certainly are friendly hackers, as you call them, which when engaged correctly and appropriately and safely, can be used for good purposes. We're actually seeing companies engage third-party security firms to conduct what's called red team activities. So the third-party firm will actually try to hack into the company and do it through not only brute force trying to penetrate the network, but also by conducting like social engineering and spear phishing, sending emails to employees saying, hey, click on this. This is the company, and we need more information. So that is absolutely useful in training employees in protecting and not falling prey to bad hackers.
I heard some hesitation in your voice when you said friendly hackers. Do you believe that they exist?
I do. I mean, there certainly are. very, very skilled technical people who can assist both the company and the government in figuring out the motives of the bad hackers, and also training companies and training government to more, you know, appropriately safeguard their information.
I mean, it does, as you look back or probably even look ahead, it does feel like a cat and mouse game between, if we're talking about companies and we'll be talking about governments as well, between these organizations and the hackers that want to get inside.
Yeah, it is a cat and mouse game, and it is incredibly difficult to stay ahead of the curve from a company and private perspective. The bad actors are just incredibly sophisticated, and some, you know, right, some are not. Some are teenagers sitting in their parents' basement in some you know, country, or even in the United States, just bored and trying to cause some havoc and see what they can do. But it is an effort that requires ongoing awareness, ongoing work and resources, and like we said earlier, a shift in the culture of an organization to really make privacy and cybersecurity top of mind.
And complicating it, I'm assuming, is we're talking about really a global problem. It's not a problem just affiliated with the United States.
Absolutely, absolutely. Cybersecurity is very much a global problem, and a lot of a lot, but not all of the bad actors originate overseas, and some are sponsored by governments, and some are not. Some are completely unaffiliated, but it is very much a global issue, and often impacts multinational companies whose customers and employees' data, you know, relates to people worldwide.
And is China the number one place for these bad actors? Can we say?
China, yeah, I can't say with any sort of authority, but it certainly is among the countries from which we have seen certain, you know, hacktivist groups originate.
And looking ahead, what are some of the challenges that you see on the horizon?
I think we're going to continue to see the frequency of the attacks, the sophistication and the scale of the attacks just continue to escalate. While there is an increased awareness, while companies are doing more to protect information and their systems, we're constantly fighting an uphill battle. That being said, I'm optimistic. This is not a lost cause. I think we are in a better position than we were, and we're going to continue to grow and to learn and you know, protect ourselves from all different forces. There are very discrete things that companies can do to help protect themselves.
Well, on that note, Brittany Bacon, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Very much appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Associate with Hunton and Williams, LLP, specializing in privacy and cybersecurity. We have two guests waiting in the wings, and we will continue this conversation focusing more on personal privacy and security. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The massive hack of the government's Office of Personnel Management is a warning to all of us that much of our personal information could be insecure. Our online communication could be vulnerable to attack. We do want to talk about internet security, personal privacy, how to protect yourself from hackers and from surveillance. And we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studio is Kate Krause, Director of Communications for the TOR Project. And that's a nonprofit that makes privacy tools, including the Tor browser. Kate Krause, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us by telephone is Julia Angwin. She's a senior reporter for ProPublica, wrote a book last year called Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And Julia Angwin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Julia, if I can begin with you, and just anything you want to say, perhaps even what you have learned about this hack of the Office of Personnel Management, something like 21 people affected, personal information that was hacked. Are there any lessons there that we can apply to our own personal lives?
Well, I mean, the very sad lesson from that hack is that, you know, the government, who actually has sort of the NSA and its best tech people on the job, is not able to protect its data from these kind of really intrusive hacks, right? Yeah. They got 21 million records of really sensitive information, kind of the worst case scenario of a hack. And what that says for most people is like, well, there's no hope for me, right? There's no way I'm going to be able to keep my personal data safe when the government can't even do it.
How about for you, Kate? Any takeaway for you?
I agree with what Julia said, but I also see it as cultural. I think that sometimes it's been difficult for government agencies to really culturally get behind moving very, very quickly into a situation where huge masses of data are encrypted and are made safe when, you know, business as usual has been okay for decades and decades, and now all of a sudden this change has to happen. And I think it's difficult. It's a difficult adjustment that so many Americans are paying the price for right now.
And culturally, meaning just sort of changing the whole way of thinking at work and thinking about how you access data or how you share data or how you information.
Yes, there are so many rules for taking care of, you know, say, patient data at the Veterans Administration, and people take it very, very seriously. There are multiple ways that you're supposed to take care of the data, and you're locking up your files, and you're being careful about where you put the key. And there are rules around where to put the key. But there are no rules yet in some cases for just the massive change that has to happen. And so people, I think, you know, many people have good intentions, but that has not, unfortunately, been enough.
Well, Julia, just picking up on that, how has, I guess, the right to privacy, how has that been changed or even challenged in our digital age?
Well, I think that, like, we are all struggling with this change, right? It's been so recent, right, that we carry these phones around with us all the time. That's only 5-10 years, right? Computers, the fact that we're on screens all the time, maybe another 10 years. And we're sort of in thrall of the excitement of it all, but it's slowly dawning on everyone that there are risks. And the risks are that you're always sending off signals that you can't control, right? So your phone is constantly talking to the network in ways that you can't understand or monitor. And there are companies that are using that to track you. There are governments that are using that to track you. There are hackers and criminals who are using that. And so there's so many opportunities for us to be exploited, for our data to be exploited in this new world. And very few people have the tools or the tech expertise to protect themselves. I do want to say one thing, which is I think I mistakenly left the impression that people should feel hopeless. I actually don't think they should. I think
good.
That there are tools.
No, that's good. And we will pick up on that. In fact, the reason that the two of you are here is that there are tools and things that people can do. But I wonder, Kate, picking up on what Julia just said, whether for the sake of convenience, we either willingly or unwillingly give up information to other people, whether it's companies or whether it's to the government.
The tools are new, and the leak of this information into the databases of, you know, national agencies or big corporations is silent. And we haven't often yet seen the other shoe drop, where we see the bad thing that can happen. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's different about the United States is that bad things have happened around data in the past, but not on the wholesale level that some other countries have experienced. So when you look at Germany takes this issue extremely seriously because they've lived through the Stasi era and they lived through the World War II. For us, it hasn't been, you know, the rubber has not hit the road in quite the same way. So we're in this halcyon period right now where all your data is sitting in a warehouse in Utah, but you don't realize that and you don't think about it yet. And then, all of a sudden, you know, people may begin to start to use it against us. And that has not really happened on a wholesale level. And so I think it's hard for people to imagine that these harmless tools that we have that are almost like toys are, in the case of an iPhone or another phone, sometimes we call them a spy in your pocket.
Because you are being tracked in many ways.
Your microphone can be turned on. Your camera can be turned on remotely without your knowledge, regardless of your settings. And people don't always realize that.
And Julia, you even tried to sort of get, I guess, hide from all this surveillance.
Right.
I mean, that's in a sense what your book was about, your attempts to not be found. How successful were you?
Well, you know, I think it's important to say that I was testing the premise, right? The premise that you just asked, which everyone asks, which is, aren't we just trading privacy for convenience?
Right.
So I said, okay, fine, I'm going to stop doing that, right? I'm going to make my life more inconvenient, and I'm going to make all these privacy choices. And so, you know, I did everything as simple as quitting using Google Search, because they store all your searches and they analyze them. And I use a search engine called DuckDuckGo that doesn't track your searches. And I used a phone that was registered in another name. I set up fake identities. I had, you know, it was a really elaborate scheme. I had software that for encryption. I had software to browse anonymously. And my life was inconvenient. But the thing that was really a bummer about it was that I wasn't that successful. I mean, even though I went to probably the lengths that most people wouldn't go, you know, I'm still trackable. Because living in the modern world is about being tracked. If you want to be in touch with people, you have to have a phone. And, you know, having this one and another number meant no one knew my number. Right.
Right?
So
right.
It was, like, really helpful.
Right.
So in the end, I felt like, you know, it's a false choice. We're presented with this idea that we gave up our privacy. I mean, we weren't given a choice. In order to participate in the world today, you don't have the option. And I would like there to be an option without all the inconvenience that I went through.
Well, to you, Kate, and even going back to the Tor project, which is giving people tools, I guess, to protect their privacy, how does that work?
The Tor project is a nonprofit organization full of people who are interested in human rights, and we make free software. We like to say free as in freedom and free as in, like, free stuff that you can download. And you download it. It opens it up. It's like a web browser, almost like Firefox, but it has a lot of privacy features built in. And it allows you to basically surf, to browse the web anonymously and privately. So, for example, you go to your doctor or you're worried you have a lump on your breast and you wonder if it's breast cancer and you're going to make a doctor's appointment. But in the meantime, you want to, like, look stuff up about breast cancer online. Well, right now, very frequently, there is no encryption. There is no code. You know, people can look right in and see that it's you. See what you're concerned about. It goes into your browser history. That goes right to Google. And while your health records, there are legal protections for people's health records. As far as I know, there are no legal protections for people's browsing history. You know, so basically your most private stuff is no longer private. It's gone right to a company. It's on a permanent server. Regardless of what you delete, it's always going to be at Google forever or for a long, long time. And that's where you begin to lose control of your information. If you use the Tor browser to look for these very same things, you'll be completely anonymous. People, you know, will not see that it's you, and they will not see what you're looking for, and, you know, you're much, much safer. It's also true that these records last for a long, long time. So maybe 20 years from now, people will say, she's looking for long-term care insurance. I think she may have had breast cancer in the past, even though it's not, you know, we don't have access to that record. I wonder if we should be charging her more for long-term care insurance. So there are implications down the road that we don't even know about, and Tor protects all of that. It keeps your data private, both from companies and also from our government and governments abroad, you know, from collecting that stuff and also watching you online in real time.
Julia, I think you used Tor, didn't you, as part of your
effort? I did use Tor. Yeah, and Tor is great because it's one of the few – there's a lot of privacy tools out there that legitimately are hard to use. And Tor is actually one of the simple ones, which is really great. It looks and feels just like a regular web browser. And it does sometimes – I'm sorry to say this, Kate, but it is obviously a little bit slower because what it does is it hops your data around the world to mask where you really are. So you know, it might look like you're browsing from Amsterdam and you're sitting, you know, if you're sitting in New York, and so your traffic is a little slower, but I actually don't find it that slow. And it's worth it, particularly if I'm doing something sensitive. You know, as a journalist, when I'm researching my upcoming story, that's extremely sensitive information. It's what I'm going to be reporting about. And so for that, Tor is the best option for me.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Julia Angwin. She's a senior reporter for ProPublica. Wrote a book in 2014 last year called Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Also with us is Kate Krause. She's director of communications for the Tor Project. We were just talking about that. That's a nonprofit that makes privacy tools, including the Tor browser. And we are talking about privacy, internet security, perhaps insecurity as well, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kate, let me just ask you one or two questions about Tor, because it has been associated with the dark net,
yes,
you know, with criminals. It also had a relationship with the U.S. government, with the Navy. Mm-hmm. I believe the Navy provided some of the, or the government provided some financing for Tor.
Mm-hmm.
Just clear that up for us, yeah, or help us understand all of that, and then we'll get to some callers here.
Certainly. The dark net is a whole bunch of things. One characteristic of it, well, let me just start by saying we actually call it hidden services,
hidden services.
That's how we see it.
Right.
And where a user using the Tor browser is kept anonymous by using that browser and private, there is a situation when certain websites or even like a texting service or something might want to be private and anonymous themselves. And you might say, like, why would you ever need that? And then if you look at the country of Iran and you realize that there are journalists right now, working journalists, who need to be able to publish their work. But if the government realizes who they are, or where this website is, and they can track them down, they will pick them up and they will throw them into prison. So there are a lot of what we call use cases, or basically uses, for this technology. And it allows the website, it allows the service to stay private online. The New Yorker has a site on a hidden service site. The Washington Post has one. Mm-hmm. I believe Amnesty International has one. And they are usually not indexed by Google, although there are different services. You can actually get to them through Google. So that is what the purpose of it is. And
the money part?
Well, let me just add, the hidden services are only 3% of Tor's daily traffic. So it's a minute amount of traffic. The funding, we started out as a Navy project. Paul Siversen at the U.S. Navy Naval Laboratory in Washington, D.C., started the project and then handed it over to Nick Matheson and Roger Dingeldine, who are the two co-founders of Tor. And we have had government funding throughout our 10-year history, but we are absolutely independent. We're a nonprofit organization that applies for grants like everyone else. We're not like someone tells us to jump and then we jump how high. We decide what we want to do. We brainstorm. And all of our code is developed in public. You can actually go onto an internet relay channel. Actually, I'll give it to you right now. You can actually look at it right now. Hashtag Tor, TOR-project. And you can watch us talking and watch us working. Our code is open, which means you can literally look at the code and make sure that it's what it says it is. And we do this thing called reproducible builds, which is where very uniquely you can actually take our code if you're an experienced software person and make our product. So you can, we're not just saying it does the thing. You can do it. You can sort of take the cake mix and see that it turns into a cake and not a monster. So, you know, we take our independence incredibly seriously, and we are now in the process of diversifying funding. We get money from Reddit. We get money from the National Science Foundation. We're applying for money from different foundations.
Anything you want to add to that, Julia?
I guess I would just say that, like, the thing about Tor is that it is it's very funny to me watching from the sidelines, because it gets the criticism that it's both a government project and that it's the run for criminals. And it's sort of amusing, because you kind of have to pick one if you're gonna, and the truth is it's neither, right? It's one of the most transparent projects ever that you can watch it as they build it.
But even beyond Tor, though, Julia, you know, it seems like when you have privacy and the ability to hide from outsiders, that is or could create a place for bad people, for criminals.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, to hide out
really
as well.
Good, yes. And that's a good point, because, you know, I actually struggle with that, because I'm a journalist and my job is actually to sort of root out government secrets. I mean, at the very base level, I'm for transparency. I spend my whole life fighting for transparency. And so then to turn around and be saying, you know, I want to keep things private, I do sometimes think, gosh, is that hypocritical? But the truth is that I have come to believe, after thinking about it a lot, that you can't, that it's not about me being private and the government being transparent. It's about power, right? And we have to hold people who are in power accountable. And they like to hide behind secrecy. So one of the things, you know, we've learned, for instance, through the Snowden documents, is how much the government was hiding behind the veil of secrecy that was really spying on Americans that they themselves have basically said, no, we're not going to do anymore, because actually now that it's sort of seen the light of day, it doesn't fit with our idea of what we should do. And so I think that it's better to frame it as holding people in power accountable, which is why I don't want Google to have my data unless they're going to promise me how they're going to treat it, right? And they're not making those promises. And so if we had a balanced situation where they made me promises and I also opened up my kimono and we had a trusting relationship, you know, then it's okay. But right now, that's not the situation I'm in with these big institutions.
Where you feel, and the big institutions would be either government institutions or business of some sort, Julia?
Yeah, and I mean, look, of course there are going to be criminals who hide behind privacy, too, and that is always going to be true. And what I say to that is, you know, the FBI head has said, okay, we have to have a secret key to open up encryption because criminals use encryption. And, you know, what I say is, like, criminals use cars, and criminals use banks, and criminals use all sorts of things. And I think that the idea that just that criminals use them makes them bad is not the right thing. The question is, how do you address criminal use of those services? And do they have the right tools to do that? Now, I think you can debate whether they have the right tools, but the interesting thing is that crime is down so much in this country, right? 50% in the past 40 years. It's an unprecedented time of lack of criminal activity in the United States. And so I think it's a hard argument to make that the criminals are running wild because of these tools.
And let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about internet security, personal privacy, how to protect yourself against hackers, against surveillance. Julia Angwin, senior reporter for ProPublica, wrote a book called Dragnet Nation, and Kate Krause, director of communications for the Tor Project. We have a lot of calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us.
Does Reddit play by the rules of social norms, or is Reddit the no-rules social media play?
In saying, we have a harassment problem, by acknowledging that, whether or not they take more action will change the narrative of what happens to this company.
Do trolls have rights? Are sites like Reddit selling speech or protecting hate? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
Get more interesting today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We were talking about the Office of Personnel Management being hacked. Well, I see that Ashley Madison has been hacked as well. We're talking about hacking and surveillance. And again, with our guests, Kate Krause and Julia Angwin. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get some callers in, including, looks like, Samuel from South Philadelphia. Hi, Samuel. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I have just basically a two-part question. My first part of the question is, these are both directed at the woman from Tor.
Yes, okay.
My first part of the question is that it's pretty well known on internet forums that Tor has a backdoor to the NSA. Now, I'd just like to see how you respond to that. It's a pretty well understood fact on the internet that your code is not secure due to the fact that as it relays through the nodes, they're able to pick up on it. And I would also like to ask you, How is the legality of the end node? Essentially, what will happen is, and I've heard stories of essentially people being prosecuted for what comes out of their end node and then gets transmitted over their ISP is illegal data. But since it comes over their end node of the Tor, it was not their data that they sent. Yet they are still being prosecuted and investigated for this. Any comments?
Okay, Samuel, thanks for calling. Let's take the first one, having Tor having a backdoor to the NSA, as Samuel says.
Yes. I just want to say that the people who use Tor include Amnesty International, Edward Snowden, the United States Navy, and the United States FBI.
Interesting mix of people.
Yes. And that if he would like to see the software being made or he would like to look at the code himself, he can just Google for Tor's source code and he can look at it himself. If he's a software developer, he can actually reproduce it. It's definitely, you know, an important, we feel extremely vehement and very strongly that we are completely independent and we will never, never accept a backdoor.
So if the code is secure?
Yes. If you want to see several other people talking about this issue, you can go to the CCC talk. Just Google CCC and State of the Onion, and you'll get a video talking about how strongly we feel about this.
I don't even understand what that means.
The thing that he's describing is that when you go to a website and you're using the Tor browser, there are three hops from three of thousands and thousands of volunteers' computers. The final hop goes to the website that you are going to. If you are doing something illegal, it will be like available right at that moment. But it's still encrypted, actually. But in any case, sometimes that very endpoint can be watched, and people who are running the endpoint, and so that could be a university. It's called an exit node. Universities run them. Usually, people with a ton of computer. MIT runs them. Libraries are going to start running them. I hope the Philadelphia Library will consider it. But sometimes, if something bad happens through that, you'll get a knock on the door. And so, people that run those exit nodes, we encourage them to visit their local police department, explain how Tor works, and literally that's what we do. We also train law enforcement so they understand how it works. We see this as a right to privacy. We see Tor as part of the infrastructure of the internet to allow, you know, walls between things like, say, the CIA and the CIA torture report that the Senate is looking over, where the CIA actually hacked into Senate files when they were looking at the torture report. That's a terrible indication of the collapse of, you know, of important democratic functions. And Tor allows those things to stay separate. So that's, we see this as a point of principle.
Samuel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Julia, I just want to toss a question to you. And I'm thinking about our listeners who are listening to us and thinking, okay, what can I do? What am I doing that might reveal more information about myself than I would like? And are there certain simple, basic things that people can do if they want to still stay connected, but also feel like, gosh, I don't want everyone to know my business?
I have four sort of top things that are pretty easy that I think people should do, because I get this question a lot. So the first thing you can do is you can start using a more private search engine. So as I mentioned, I use something called DuckDuckGo, which is actually based in Philadelphia and is a private search engine so that my data is not stored. So that's simple. You just start using it instead of Google and see how you like the results. I find them just as good. The only thing is that since they don't know all that information about you, they don't try to fill out what you're typing while you're typing it. And so it actually is kind of relaxing when you realize that they're not trying to read your mind. The next thing that I think is really important, and everyone groans when I say this, but your password, I don't know what your password is, but I know it's not good enough.
Oh, really?
So basically, if there's one password that you're going to strengthen, it should be your password to your email. And that's because your email, you can use it to reset all your other accounts, you know, when you say forgot password. So if somebody gets into your email, they can reset all your accounts and get into everything. So
let me just stop you there. As you say, know it's you don't know our passwords, but you know it's not good enough. Is that because it's the name
because
of our
it
kid.
It should be 40 characters long.
It should be 40 characters 40, long?
Yeah, is yours 40 characters
No,
long?
Of course not.
No, it's a not. So therefore, so I'm making an educated guess based that nobody's got a 40-character long password except me and my daughter. But if you can get it to 30, every bit of length that you can add helps.
Okay.
So that's a very important thing to do. Another thing is, adding online banking is the one thing you really don't want the hackers to get into, and so that's like an immediate threat. And so it's important to go into your online banking account and make sure that there's a second password. A lot of them just have one password to log in. You can usually find in the settings you can enable a second password so that before a payment is made, basically you have to enter your PIN or some new password. So that way, even if somebody gets in, they can't make a payment from your account.
Anything you want to add to this, Kate?
I think those are great suggestions. I would encourage people to start, obviously, using the Tor browser. You just go to www.torproject.org, and there's a huge button. You press the button and follow the instructions. And then what I also often encourage people to do is, if you have an Android or an iPhone, you can go to whispersystems.org, like whispering, whispersystems.org, and download. If you have an iPhone, you would use something called Signal. And if you have an Android phone, you would use TextSecure for texting, TextSecure, and RedPhone for phoning. And those are super easy to use texting, like phone texting application, right, and encrypted phone. So all of a sudden, the spy in your pocket can't hear you anymore. And that can be a really powerful thing. You know, phones are still problematic, but this is a, and like the reason I like this is because you can sit at a table and have lunch with a friend and just show them your phone and show them and you know, and get them to download it while you're waiting for dessert or something. And then all of a sudden they have a really pretty super secret way to share information that they didn't have before.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Linda from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'll try to make this really quickly.
Sure.
I have two kids in school, and you guys were talking about institutions and data mining and stuff. I would like to introduce another one. The school districts now are outsourcing a lot of their records to third-party data holders, whether it's your child's photograph on picture day or when they do their little ear and medical tests and at school, from their test scores, and just goes on and on and on. And as a concerned parent, I'm wondering if the two guests can maybe give some advice as to how to start protecting their information, because the districts aren't usually forthcoming as to where that information is going and who's holding it for them.
Well,
thank you.
Thanks, Linda, for calling in. Actually, Julia, can I toss that first to you and then to you, Kate?
Sure. Yeah, this is something I spend a lot of time on because I have two kids who are at school, and I struggle with it a lot. So the big picture is that there's a law that protects student privacy, but it has loopholes because it was written 30 years ago. And basically, a lot of those loopholes allow for data stored on third-party vendors to be exempted from some of the protections. So that's item one. But item two is a lot of the schools are really just uneducated. So I'll never forget the day my daughter came home and she said, my homework assignment is to do a voice blog post where I talk on and post something on this blog. So I looked at the terms of service and it said we have the right to own your recording and sell it and give it to marketers. And so I said, I had to write a note to the teacher, like, we're not doing that homework. You know, you shouldn't assign that homework. Some easy things that you can do as a parent is I, every year, refuse to sign the photo release form because it's a very broad release form and they want to put your kid's photo everywhere. And then if they do insist, and then if there's any photos that they really, really want to post, I ask for them not to put captions. Because if your kids aren't identified in the text on the photo, then it's actually a lot harder to find the photo. So I have some hope that it would remain somewhat hidden. And the other thing is that you have to also realize that the schools are just not that tech literate. So if you have some skills you can bring to bear, you know, my daughter, for instance, taught everyone in her class how to make better passwords, including the teacher, right, because she learned it from me.
I hope she got an A for that.
So I think that if there are any skills you can bring to bear, or you can, you know, I hate to say this, read my book and bring that in. But there are lots of things that are really easy that the schools could be doing. They could be teaching their kids to use the Tor browser. They could be teaching them, you know, to make better passwords. And a lot of them just don't know what to teach.
You want to add to that, Kate?
I would just ask them if the data is encrypted. Ask them how they store the data and do it in a way that you share with other parents. Mm. My other suggestion is that the same things that you might be concerned about for this organization, you might be easily posting to Facebook. And as a Philadelphian, you know, when you post your children's photos to Facebook, you're creating this profile that's going to last their whole year. You're the first person in there making the profile that then can be sold. Or what if Facebook becomes the next Friendster and they need to sell off assets? That's money in the bank for the people that are running the company, whenever that is. So you don't want to contribute to that wherever possible.
Does that mean don't post at all?
Or? I would say minimizing. You know, you can send photos through your phone in an encrypted way in using the programs that I just described. And, you know, in Philadelphia, we have porches. You know, more porch parties, less Facebook.
Oh, okay. Fair, fair enough. Nothing like the fresh outdoors. Let me get Krista from Rittenhouse Square. Hi, Krista. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi. Good discussion today.
Thank you.
I have a question about, I am a, number one, a Tor user, and it's my understanding to say this way often, to use Tor because the government and your internet provider can tell that you are a Tor user. They won't know what you're doing. It's to use it through a VPN, provided you purchase the VPN anonymously, say with either store-bought credit card that's not in your name. Some also let you use gift certificates. And then, of course, you download it at a public Wi-Fi. Would that be a better way that the government or the internet won't know that you're using Tor? And then the other thing is about the fingerprint, that every computer has a specific fingerprint with respect to what's been downloaded onto their computer in general. And so it's usually better to use these things at a public Wi-Fi.
Okay. And No, I appreciate, Chris, I appreciate the call. I'm tossing that to you, Kate.
What we've learned about VPNs is that they are a central point for your data that can be attacked. You have one project and it's to attack this one computer, and then you get the jackpot of everyone's data. We don't recommend that people use VPNs.
Oh, really?
No, at all. We just recommend that they use Tor browser, and there are 2 million users a day at a minimum. The whole point of it is to make you blend in with this huge group of diverse people from all over the world with millions of agendas for using Tor, and that is the sort of structure of the privacy that we create. One thing I didn't get a chance to add, or I should have added earlier, is we are seeing more and more that people try and get into your computer by using your insecure, unupdated other browser as a way to try and get to Tor. We have no proof that Tor has been broken, but we can see different companies and different people trying to get in, not through Tor, which they can't seem to crack, but through your old Firefox browser, which you thought was updated but wasn't. So we really strongly encourage people to not assume that your stuff has been up. You may think it has, but who knows? Check and update your other browsers. Update your system software. 2 days ago, there was a vulnerability announced by Microsoft that every single person in, I guess, the world, every single Windows version is compromised. And there is an update that you must download. Maybe you've already set it up to download, but you should check that. So check your browsers, your other browsers, and also don't use Flash. Firefox has just banned Flash, and it's a way that there are millions of vulnerabilities all the time, ways to get in, and we want to prevent that. So we don't encourage people to use Flash.
Julie, do you think it's smart to be just a little bit paranoid these days?
Yeah, sadly. I mean, I don't like to be a paranoid person because it's not a fun way to live. But I think that it's sort of like the way that it would just be stupid to walk into a car dealership and just take the first offer. I feel like that's how we have been with our technology. We're just taking the first offer of everything because they're like, oh, it's free. I want it. And I think what's happening is we're growing up and realizing it's a negotiation. And sometimes it's worth it, and sometimes it's better to really just use Tor and keep your data private.
And are you back on Google search, or have you stayed off of that?
No, not at all. I actually never use it. No, I don't miss it. I find everything I need. And, you know, I'm an investigative journalist, so I have, like, very high information needs. And I do find everything I need.
Well, that's good to know. And my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Julia Engwin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior reporter for ProPublica. Wrote a book last year called Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Kate Krause, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you very much.
And Director of Communications for the Tor Project, again, a nonprofit that makes privacy tools, including the Tor browser. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about our program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, and how to follow us on Twitter. Also, how to get our newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.